dumping poison into our drinking water. You can't do that if you believe that the drinking water is really clean. It's kind of like, we all know that if you go out to eat with someone and they order a dessert and you have a few bites of it, those calories don't really count. That's really, yeah, we all know that, right? But it's sort of like this world is like those calories that aren't really real. They don't really count, they aren't really, you know, important. And if you believe that, then it's very easy to sacrifice what's actually here in the service of some abstraction. And for the Jesuits, it might have been God in heaven, but what that has turned into in our culture, in our time, is this abstraction of money and profit. Somehow or other that overrides everything that any sane person would look at and say, you know, this is not worth doing. You know, the water crisis in Flint, you've probably heard of on the news, you know, again, if you think about that, like, you can ask, what level of insanity do you have to be at to think that it's okay to poison children in order to save a few bucks? You know, I live on the West Coast where we are, you know, still concerned about the impact of Fukushima and what's happening with that. When the nuclear power plant was melting down, our government decided to protect us from having to worry about increased radiation on our shores by not measuring it. Stop measuring. Again, it's like if you don't measure it, somehow it's like those calories. It doesn't really count. In the same world, why would we build something that if it goes wrong, all the world's top scientists have no idea how to clean it up? They really don't know what to do with it. Continue to want to build more and more of those things, again, because we have some kind of deep rift inside us that doesn't allow us to actually comprehend the values that I think are the values we need in order to survive, which is the values, again, that indigenous cultures, like the Onondaga, and that the old European cultures also told us were the true values. The value of the earth, the value of the water, the value of the things that really sustain our lives. So I like to think about what is sacred, and not in the sense of what is it we bow down to, but what is it that is most important. What is it that's important to us that goes beyond our personal convenience or our profit? You know, what is it we care enough about that we might take a stand for? And I want to start by reading you something from City of Refuge, which is my newest book, which is a sequel to a book I wrote 20 years ago called The Fifth Sacred Thing. This actually is something that came from this sacred thing. It's called The Declaration of the Four Sacred Things. And I'll say that I think a lot of us are hungry to go back or to go forward to a kind of a worldview that does integrate this sense of relationship with everything around us. And a lot of us crave a more indigenous worldview. But we can't necessarily just go take somebody else's culture, take some piece of it. I think we have to somehow find our way to a kind of new indigenous worldview that comes from ourselves, taking what we can take from our culture, and consciously also being willing to listen, to look, to learn from the natural world, and feel our way back to some kind of balance that will probably be different from what people did 5,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. thinking about this, I was writing about a potential future, not that far ahead, maybe mid-21st century, and thinking like, what if people were able to come together around this conception of the sacred? This is the declaration. The earth is a living, conscious being. In company with cultures of many different times and places, we name these things as sacred. Air, fire, water, and earth. Whether we see them as the breath, energy, blood, and body of the mother, or as the blessed gifts of a creator, or as symbols of the interconnected systems that sustain life, we know that nothing can live without them. To call these things sacred is to say that they have a value beyond their usefulness for human ends, that they themselves become the standards by which our acts, our economics, our laws, and our purposes must be judged. No one has the right to appropriate them or profit from them at the expense of others. Any government that fails to protect them forfeits its legitimacy. All people, all living beings are part of the earth life, and so are sacred. No one of us stands higher or lower than any other. Only justice can assure balance. Only ecological balance can sustain freedom. Only in freedom can that fifth sacred thing we call spirit flourish in its full diversity. To honor the sacred is to create conditions in which nourishment, sustenance, habitat, knowledge, freedom, and beauty can thrive. To honor the sacred is to make love possible. To this, we dedicate our curiosity, our will, our courage, our silences, and our voices. To this, we dedicate our lives. So, starting with that, one of the questions I always like to ask is, what would the world look like? What would be different if we actually took values like that as the core of our culture? We actually build our society around that honoring of those things that sustain life and those processes that actually care for and nourish and nurture life. And I think this process of asking those questions and envisioning a positive kind of potential future and potential past is really important right now. Because I think a lot of people feel very hopeless, and it's easy to feel that way. In fact, you might say it's rational to feel that way. And certainly if you listen to the news or you observe your dwindling savings account or you go out and see, you know, the smokestacks and the chimneys, still there around what once was the sacred lake, it's very easy to get discouraged. But I believe that in order to change things, we need to be able to at least imagine and envision something different. And it's a magical teaching that to create change or to create something, you first have to envision it. You have to know not just what you don't want, but what you want. There's a linguist named George Lakoff. He's also a political theorist. Some of you might be familiar with him. He's written a number of books, and one called Don't Think of an Elephant. He says no one cannot think of an elephant because as soon as you say elephant, the elephant's in your mind. And he talks about how the Republicans tend to be much better at this than the Democrats. The Democrats are always trying to talk to people in terms of policy and this fact and that statistic and, you know, what's doable, what's actually doable. And the Republicans tend to talk in terms of moral values and to frame things in terms of moral values. They often frame things in terms of moral values that
worked.
They have a way of making them sound like moral values so that you'll notice they're actually not. But they're very good at that. And what he says is you've got to look at the frame. You know, if you look at a frame of something like austerity, you know, that is a giant metaphor. You hear the word austerity, it sounds like something sort of noble, valuable. You know, it sounds like sort of stripping yourself down to get rid of the frills and the non-essentials of life. Going back to, you know, what's kind of clean and lean and important. If we talk about more austerity or less austerity, we're doomed, we're lost. Because what austerity really means is taking away the pension that you worked hard for all your life so that somebody else can have more unnecessary luxuries while you are scrambling around your old age desperately trying to get enough money to keep the heat on you. That's not something noble and good. David Graeber, who's also a wonderful writer, wrote a book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. He says, instead of talking about austerity, we should be talking about neo-feudalism. Because that's really the system that we're finding ourselves getting sucked into. And we rename it and we reframe it. And then we can contest it effectively. But if you buy into the frame, then you are lost. So we have to look at the frame and again, look at the story. What is the overarching story? You know, if we buy into the overarching story, that what is most important is the bottom line and the profit share, then we'll, you know, we argue about how much profit or how little profit we're lost. But if we challenge that story and say, well, actually, what's most important is leaving a viable world for the next generations, then we have a hope of actually bringing about change. So I love to do the work of visioning. And I wanted to maybe share a couple of pieces from City of Refuge about some of the evolving vision of what it would be like. How many of you have actually, have any of you read the Forsaken thing? Well, for those of you who haven't, it actually came for me out of hearing where I was looking at this transition in ancient Europe and the Middle East from matrifocal kind of female-based societies that were based around honoring the sacredness of the life principle to patriarchy and warlike culture. And how that process had gone on in many, many different parts of the world. You know, that for me was something that came out of the feminist movement in the 70s when we started looking around and saying, was there ever anything other than patriarchy? And, you know, because if there wasn't, maybe there never had been patriarchy. If there was, then maybe there's a possibility for men. And we started looking around and I think it's really significant here in Syracuse that we have a living tradition of women having a role of power and responsibility and authority, and understanding that even the early European settlers who came here got exposed to this culture. Influenced deeply our democratic structures, and also influenced the early women's movement. Seneca Falls on, you know, looking being able to go around and say, well, yeah, there not only was, there still is cultures where women are more and more respected, and women are central, and women have agency and authority. And as we began looking back into Europe and the Middle East, what we found was if you go back far enough, this is true in European history. Maria Gimbutas' work, the archaeology, archaeologist who did so much work on old Europe, that period $6,500 to about $3,500 in BCE, where it's agriculture, architecture, building, cities, and all these things were first taking form. What you find there are all these images of goddesses and archetypes and images of sacred life, animals and plants and spiders and all these things that represent life forces in different aspects. And where this begins to change and shift and break down is when warfare becomes incarnate and organized. And people begin wars of conquest and begin to understand that patriarchy, in a sense, is war ideology. It is designed to encourage men not just to be aggressive or warlike, because, men and women too sometimes are generally willing to do that without too much encouragement. But to do it in a particular way, a way where you are organized so that you have to override your own instincts for survival. You know, you're standing there in line, arm in arm with your brothers and their shields and their spears as chariots come thundering down. And what do you have to do to someone to get them to not run away? Or maybe you have to convince them that to be a coward and to run away is worse than you get. And how do you do that? Well, maybe you make that seem so shameful and so painful. And maybe you also make the rewards of standing there in conquering so enticing that you can convince them to basically give up their autonomy, because that's what you have to do to be not only a warrior if you are in the tribe, but a soldier if you are in the army. And in order to do that, you have to use women as prizes of war, and use rape as a weapon of war, and take away women's autonomy and women's, particularly women's body autonomy. You have to make some people have enormously high value and other people have no value, so they are expendable. And you end up with a system that I think actually isn't really that great for women or for men, but it's deeply, deeply damaging to us all. So I was looking at that and wondering, okay, you can see how this takes place. You can trace it in shifts in mythology. You can trace it in art. You can trace it in the laws. But, how could it be different? How could a peaceable society resist violence without either being conquered or destroyed or becoming more like what they're fighting against? And for me, that was sort of the central question in the fifth sacred thing. Projected it into the future, because that way I take a break from doing historical research, just make things up. Laziness, great creative force. And I imagined in Northern California, where I live now, they had achieved this beautiful balanced society based on the four sacred things. And in Southern California, where I grew up, they had gone the other direction and they had become more militarist, more ruthless, and more stratified. And looked at what happens when the Southlands invade the North. So, I won't tell you, because you haven't read Persephone, but I will have to tell you about the City of Refuge. Starts at a point where they managed to kick the invaders out of there. And they've done that by actually transforming the bulk of their army, getting them to come over and defend. And yards where they're cleaning up. And I just want to read you a few little passages that I think might bring alive some of that picture of what would this assembly look like if we built it around these values. You know, what would it look like if, you know, last night I was talking with two teachers, a music teacher and an art teacher, about the sort of dismal state of teaching and arts and culture. What would it look like if art and music and the things that give us joy and pleasure and beauty were seen as really vitally important? And not just like those extra calories on your dessert. What would it be like if we actually took pleasure as good? Not like just exploiting the pleasure, but the kind of pleasure that we get from being in the presence of something that's really, truly nourishing and beautiful. What if that were the standard of what we try to create as culture? So the drum is the healer from the fifth sacred. A broken-nosed baby, that's what we are, thought the drum as she picked her way with a tangled mass of torn-up trees and chunks of paving left by the Stuart army in their latest invasion. Punched in the face, eyes blackened, lips split, but we're tougher than we look. We simply spit out a couple of teeth and go on. All around her lay the evidence of destruction, and all around her, as she wove her way through the tangle of paths and torn-up gardens, teams were at work, clearing away the rubble, digging new beds, pruning damaged trees. She stumbled on the deep track left by a bulldozer and came out into a cleared space overlooking the grounds of the Kingdom Center. Before the invasion, the old brick building had been surrounded by lush gardens filled with herbs used to staunch wounds, treat illnesses, and flowers to refresh the spirit. But the medicine of the city integrated the ancient knowledge of root women and cutting men into Western allopathy, along with acupuncture and Ayurveda and the physics of the East. Now the plants were trampled, the ginkgo grove as a waste ground, and the myrtles and chase trees in the women's grove overlooked a ruin of torn up leaves and shattered stalks. The Stuart's army had taken a special delight in destroying gardens and uprooting sacred groves, as if beauty and abundance offended them. We chose not to fight with bullets, but to make beauty itself our prime weapon, the drone thought. Offering it to the invaders, beckoning, join us, become us, taste our fruits. Until in the end, the soldiers of the Southlands fell into our embrace and were undone. No wonder they went after fruit trees and flower beds. They recognized their true arsenal. The worst damage was in front, where the temple had stood, a pillared pavilion draped with fragrant vines. Here, where convalescents once had come to meditate in peace, where family and friends of the sick would bring their hopes and their offerings, to lay in the niches dedicated to Hebe, Asclepius, Bridget, Mother Mary, or Kuan Yin, now lay a ruin of shattered rubble. But the temple was being rebuilt. As she did her healing work inside the wards, the workers of the city would be healing the grounds and gardens outside. We are resilient, she thought. We'll use broken concrete as the base for new sculptures and benches to rest upon, and melt down shattered glass to make new vessels. We use everything, even our vengeance. So, you can imagine this beautiful city trying to integrate thousands of soldiers who've been raised in this totally other world and other culture. And here's a little section about some of the ways the soldiers begin to be transformed. And River is one of the soldiers who made this sacred painting effective. And most of the soldiers don't have names, they just have numbers. But he went through a whole healing process and was given a name. In the center of the garden stood a red sphere on a pedestal. What's that? River asked one of the older girls. That's Mars. She looked up at him, her dark straight hair framing an owl's face.
was fine.
Thick glasses hid her dark eyes. Her blouse hid new buddy breasts, River noted, but he tried and failed to imagine how she would be in the reckoning. Already she had the eyes of the Califian women looking straight into his with no fear nor submission, as if she were a person looking at another person, one she didn't think much of. "It's our neighbor planet," she told him. "Oh, what's a planet?" She looked at him sharply as if she suspected he were joking. "We're standing on it. The Earth is a planet, like a giant ball circling the sun." "Crazy shit." "It's true. How can we all fall off them? Gravity holds us on. What's gravity?" "Gravity is the Earth's love for her children, holding us close," she said, as if repeating something to her friends. "Hey, Tulos," River shouted with old Enid, "come hear this." The girl called her friends over, and the children soon discovered that the soldiers knew almost nothing about the world. They had been taught to read, write, and count, mostly for the convenience of their commanders, but they had never been given storybooks or even textbooks or anything other than weapons and the simplest of military tactics. Their entertainment came from vid screens, vid games, and paling mad cards. They didn't know that the Earth turned around the sun, or that compass needs oil. They knew nothing of history and were unaware that Califia and the Southlands had once been part of the same state, one of 50 in the same country. They had rarely seen the night sky before they made the long march to the north, and it hadn't occurred to most of them to wonder what those patterns of light and heavens were. Stars had to be explained to them. "Help us rebuild this learning track," the girl said. "I will teach you things." "That's an order?" the two asked. Girlfriend, if you want to be, it's an offer." "An order," River said firmly. The girl held out her hand. "I'm Jasmine. What's your name?" "River." He took her hand and stood looking at her, not sure what to do with it or why she extended it to him. She grasped his, pumped it vigorously, and let it drop. "These other chicks that's here don't want names, just numbers," River told her. "So what's this track then?" "It's how we learn here. There's different tracks that run all through the city with different learning stations. Right now, we're on the solar system track, and this is the Mars station. The next one out would be Jupiter and then Saturn. It's like a giant scale model." River and the other soldiers just looked at her, mystified. So Jasmine explained that on the solar system track, every planet had a learning station. Mars had its sphere, and around it were gardens with birds that belonged to Mars, and flowers and martial ponies, along with statues of war gods from many cultures, Ares and Chango and Thor. Each had a port for the intelligent crystals that the children wore around their necks. When they reached them to the ports, holograms jumped out with stories, myths, and explanations. They could listen to the Greek and Roman myths or hear the Scandinavian myths, and then compare them to the Marvel comic school and the movies. They could watch video from the early Mars rover or access the scientific reports from expeditions scientists had mounted back when people could still do such things before the collapse. In their learning groups, they would go further into the mysteries of space exploration, or write and perform their own Mars space opera, or read Mars-centered science fiction, or create a strategy game about a Mars expedition. River understood little of her explanation, but he gathered that the children had taken on the project of replanting the gardens and cleaning up the tracks, while the techies repaired the smashed electronics and the artist guild rebuilt the sculptures. In the end, Jasmine offered to meet them on the following morning and take them to the outer planets that hadn't been damaged in the invasion. There they could see what a fully functioning station was like. Why not make it up?